Welcome to the Rust Belt Rundown, brought to you by Rust Belt Recruiting. This podcast is designed to shine a light on the meaningful work being done in Northeast Ohio and the surrounding region. We will convene manufacturing executives and Northeast Ohio business leaders for candid discussions about their business, regional happenings, industry trends, entrepreneurship, and more. Now, let's get running on the Rundown.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 73 of the Rust Belt Rundown, a production by Workforce LLC. I'm your host, Paul O'Connor, and on this episode, we are joined by Scott Paul, the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Paul, it is great to be with you.
So before we get into the meat and potatoes, you are a Penn State and Georgetown grad. Who do you root for?
It depends on the sport, I will say. So if Penn State's good at it, I'm rooting for them. But no, I'm a total Penn State fan. My wife is from the West Coast, UCLA. And so I kind of split my loyalties during basketball season. It's going to be harder with UCLA joining the Big Ten. But at any rate, I'm a total Penn State sports fan. So you don't want to get me started on that.
Well, I am a person who lives in Columbus, Ohio, who does not root for this team. So I am also, I'm a Big Ten fan. Anyone who's playing Ohio State, I am a fan of. So, go Penn State twice a year or once a year, whenever you guys play the Buckeyes, I'm rooting for you. All right, let's jump in. So let's just start with the easy one, for our listeners and our audience. Can you share with us a little bit of background on the Alliance for American Manufacturing, how it was formed, and what your mission is?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So the Alliance for American Manufacturing, first of all, we're nonpartisan, we're nonprofit, we're, I guess, sort of like a club and a think tank. It's basically a consortium of the United Steelworkers Union and companies that it has a collective bargaining relationship with. And some of those include Cleveland-Cliffs, United States Steel, some other metal companies, some tire companies. And about 17 years, they decided to form this fund to focus on lifting up public policy through research, through communications, through advocacy that would help bring more manufacturing jobs to the United States, to help popularize the idea of Made in America and Made in America policies. And so it's been the honor of my lifetime to help start this up. We have a staff of about 20 folks who are awesome people who contribute to this mission every day.
And so talk to me about your career. It's tied to a little bit of both politics and manufacturing. How did you get into both of those? And then how do you think that has influenced, your role with American Manufacturing?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great question. And it was kind of just happenstance, I would say. I was raised in a small Midwestern town in Indiana. My family was a military family and then in agribusiness and teaching. And so we didn't have a direct connection to manufacturing. But I was always interested in politics. And I was lucky enough to have a couple of internships with lawmakers from Indiana. And during the course of one of those, I ended up working on that congressman's campaign, and I would go to plant gates at manufacturing operations, and I would meet workers. And it struck me how they are unsung heroes and how hard they were working and just how fragile the state of their jobs was. It depended on so many other things that were, I mean, they could make a great widget or whatever, but if the trade policy was bad, might lose their job, no fault of their own. And it really struck home with me when one time I knocked on the door of a former classmate of mine. And it was this nice house and I'm still in college. And I'm like, hey, how you doing? And he's like, I'm doing great. I work down at this auto factory in Lafayette and I bought this home. And I was like, wow. And he was like 21 years old. And it occurred to me then that this was a great pathway to financial security and the American dream for a lot of folks. And I have to admit, I was really clueless before that about that. And that really opened my eyes to how important it was to so many communities like mine around the country. And so I was lucky to do policy work on that, on Capitol Hill for a dozen years, for people who had the foresight to see some of the problems that were going to be coming, and who cared about that. But that lifted me into kind of where I am today. So I was able to see that awareness on the ground, to talk to a lot of factory workers and owners, and then to work on a lot of these policy issues for a long time before we launched the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Yeah, I love it. That's super helpful. I think I sent this to Taylor yesterday, but it came out in the Morning Brew daily newsletter that I read. For the first time in, and you know what, let me pull it up so I don't butcher this quote, but very, very good news for just overall manufacturing in the industry. The number of students enrolled in vocational focused community colleges increased 16% from 2022 to 2023. The number of students saying studying construction at 2-year undergraduate programs rose 12%. Basically, for the first time in about 30 years, more students are going into the trades than they are traditional 4-year degrees. This writing has been on the wall for a very long time. We've talked about this at great length. I don't necessarily want to go down the rabbit hole, but it's interesting for you to your story and your arc for you to see from like the ground up how important these roles are. Then from the top down, from a policy standpoint, you can see both. And now we're seeing, what does the American dream look like? What is the best ROI on my investment? And a traditional 4-year, you know, I'm just going to pick on marketing, you know, no offense to the market, but like a traditional 4-year marketing degree might not yield what an electrician or a plumber or a car maintenance manual, like any pick your manufacturing lane or industry. And I think that's like kind of fascinating, the shift that's happening before our eyes. We talk about it at great length, but before I go to the next question, do you have any thoughts and just observations in that shift?
Yeah, I think you nailed it, Paul, is that this has been an understanding that has been a long time coming, and it's unfortunately taken us way too long. But yeah, part of that is because we saw all of this deindustrialization and a lot of the tech schools respond to demand for where the careers were. And so healthcare, other things made a lot of sense for career and technical education. But I think that we also learned, because we've seen these shortages of skilled tradesmen or what have you, that there weren't just the incentives built in or the pipelines available. It wasn't that kids didn't get it at all. It was really that the infrastructure for all of that really had eroded. And so it's good to see that we are back in the game and we have a lot of catching up to do. And we still have a big imbalance between the amount of resources that go into those 4-year college degrees versus career and technical education. And they shouldn't be pitted against each other, I don't think. But we do have to continue to elevate the career and technical education opportunities in high school and beyond high school, and to understand that that's a big part of where the future prosperity of our country resides.
Yep, 100%. Okay. Transitioning a little bit, you are a podcast host yourself. First, just tell me about the podcast. But then secondly, you know, how has it been to, you know, be in this space and play in this space and have conversations you know, guests on the show? And what have you enjoyed about, you know, podcasting?
Well, as you know, Paul, it's fun to chat with people, to have conversations about it and to share it with others. And so I've loved that opportunity. We have a podcast called The Manufacturing Report. It's been up for 7 years or so. And we've done almost 200 episodes. And I talk to a lot of folks who have built Made in America businesses, some of them from the ground up and of all different shapes and sizes and all different kinds of products. And so I love those stories, and especially the underdog stories about how they were able to build something in the United States when everybody was telling them to just outsource it. Yeah, that's a great idea, but you should just get everything from China or wherever. And so I love that. I love talking to workers. I occasionally get to talk to policymakers as well. They've all been incredibly enriching conversations. And we've talked to people even in the arts about portrayals of working class people. And how that is. And so it's been, it's one of the more enjoyable features of the job. And I've been lucky to have been able to chat with a lot of amazing folks, whose stories that, I'm happy to help lift up.
So I want to transition to just what you're seeing in the overall manufacturing market. If you live in Ohio, there's a one word that everyone has talked about for a long time, and that's Intel. But I want to get your thoughts on what you're seeing across the country, and how the CHIPS Act specifically has helped, contributed, what people may not understand about what that specific piece of legislation is going to do for manufacturing. Just an overall kind of state of the union, if you will, on manufacturing.
Yeah. Paul, thank you so much. And so I could talk for an hour about this, but I'll condense it into just a couple of minutes here. You know, I think that we discovered even before the pandemic that there was some benefit to localizing supply chains. And there was an understanding, I think, that we had kind of reached peak China, and that the costs were outweighing the benefits for a lot of firms. And then we started to see some policy realignment in the last administration with tariffs and what have you to kind of start to promote some of that. And so then we have the pandemic. Everybody understands what supply chains are about and what these disruptions are about. And so there's even more awareness of it. And it was very acute, not only for consumer products, but for things that were life-saving, right? And so I think that lifted all of that up. And then we had all sorts of supply chain bottlenecks that hit, you know, key parts like semiconductors. And we'll talk about that in a second. And then we have, you know, this administration that has made a lot of investments in the United States in infrastructure and semiconductors and clean energy manufacturing, and has continued some tariffs and sanctions to try to punish bad behavior on the part of the Chinese Communist Party. It's been and I will just say the economics are favoring the United States more and more. I mean, it is a, you know, manufacturing is, it still involves a lot of people, but it involves a lot of automation. Machines mm-hmm. generally cost the same just about everywhere. We have highly productive workers here. We have an energy advantage, and we have the largest consumer market in the world. We have 5 million people, but 5% of the world's people, we consume 20% of the world's products. And so this mm-hmm. is a great market to be in, and we've finally kind of woken up to that fact, and the fact that you're taking a lot of risk out of the supply chain if you're localizing it, like you're producing in or around the United States for our market. And so that together has helped certainly rebuild manufacturing. And you know, we'll talk semiconductors first. You know, the CHIPS Act was a federal investment in microelectronics and the semiconductor supply chain so that we could make more of our own semiconductors in the United States. At one point, we made one out of every three semiconductors in the world. That number dropped down to about 10%, but we consume a bunch of them. And so it was to a dangerous level. And so this policy will move that percentage back up and also alleviate some of the bottlenecks that we saw that made buying a car so difficult, for example, a couple of years ago, or finding an appliance or an Xbox or a TV or what have you. So, you know, there's loans and grants available for companies that want to locate their semiconductor manufacturing operations here. And these are well-paying jobs. Not all of them require a four-year college degree. And then there'll be an ecosystem of suppliers that's built around that. And so those public dollars will leverage a lot of private sector investment. And so, Paul, you cited Intel. In Ohio, there's, you know, there's semiconductor factories going in to Arizona, to New York, to Indiana, to all, I mean, you name the state and they're going to be there. And that's, you know, that's in addition to battery charger factories, to electric vehicle manufacturing, to solar. We've seen a lot of investment in states. And so there are really these new industries that are springing up. And this is, I think, the most amazing data point is that really, since they've been keeping statistics consistently, there's never been more factory construction in the United States than we're seeing right now. And so if you would have asked any, like, basically, I mean, we've been keeping consistent statistics since basically the mid-60s, okay? And so it's quite possible, and certainly during the arsenal of democracy and the factory conversions there, there was probably a bunch. But this is generational, what we're seeing. I will say it's very concentrated in those industries where you're seeing that public investment going in. So you're seeing most of this in microelectronics and clean energy, realigning the automotive manufacturing, what have you. But so it's kind of concentrated in that, but we're seeing that. And look, we're also seeing manufacturing jobs continue to move around the world. And so it's not like that has stopped at mm-hmm. all, but it's slowed a little bit from the US perspective, and we're picking things up. So we're as well positioned as we have been for a long time to see some manufacturing job growth here.
There's a lot to break down there. Let's focus on the reshoring efforts. If COVID doesn't happen, I imagine that we are not where we are at momentum wise, industry wise, in terms of the reshoring effort, for all the reasons you said, right? We needed masks here. Masks were across the world. It made more sense to make masks and, you know, pick your item. What's the current biggest, a threat seems not the right word, but obstacle to reshoring? And is there a case to have both? Can you have the best of both worlds? Can you have something to save you some money and operational costs somewhere else, Canada, Mexico? Because I think a lot of times when we say reshoring, everyone thinks, oh, well, you know, it got, and I'm sure the vast majority, you know, Japan or China, depending on what you are creating. But could you have both? Let me do a better job of asking this. One, what are the biggest obstacles to reshoring? And two, is there a world where companies can do both or have the best of both worlds?
Yeah, these are good questions about the future of reshoring. And I still don't think we've seen peak reshoring yet. I still think there's a lot of work that can be done. And that's evidenced just by we have the largest trade deficit in the world. And look, some of that isn't going to go away because it's either high volume, kind of low skill stuff, or it's food that we can't do here. And it's just going to be a fact of life. And that, I'm not bothered by that. But I do think that the biggest obstacles to reshoring are still in some publicly traded companies who have shareholders. Mm-hmm. They want to maximize shareholder value no matter what. And that means low-cost production. Now, low-cost production works when the system works, when there's not political instability or uncertainty, when there's not supply chain bottlenecks, when there's not natural disasters, when there's not unforeseen events or ships getting stuck or what have you. And so, but what we found is that stuff happens a lot. Yeah. And so you can't count on that perfectly operating system, but those are going to be the last to go. Those companies that kind of lean on that low cost, let's maximize shareholder value. And even if we're making a profit in the United States, we can make a bigger one in, say, China or India. Let's move it there. So there's still that mindset, and that hasn't been completely disrupted yet. So I think that's obstacle number one. Obstacle number two is political. And I'm saying this in a completely nonpartisan way. There's some people that don't like tariffs because it's Donald Trump who put the tariffs on. There's some people who don't like these public investments in infrastructure, in clean energy and semiconductors because Joe Biden got that through. Okay. And if people look at it that way and want to get rid of one or the other for political reasons, that's going to be a mistake, because I think taken together, they've produced a pretty potent incentive to reshore some work. Now, the uncertainty about all of this, and Paul, you kind of cited this, is where exactly does that reshored stuff come? Does it come to the US, Canada, or Mexico? And we do have a free trade agreement called the USMCA with Mexico and with Canada. And we supported that renegotiation, and it had a lot of Democratic support. And it was the last administration, the Trump administration, that did it. But what we've seen is other countries take advantage of it. We've seen Chinese companies in particular come into Mexico through the back door and then get the benefits of this agreement. And so that has to be shut for this to work effectively, because I do think that ultimately one thing we've learned over the last few years is that no one wants a shooting war with China. And I want to be clear about that. But I don't think it's ever going to be the case where China's going to be an ally of the United States. And they're always going to be an economic competitor. They're almost certainly going to be a strategic competitor. And in the past, it's been very one-sided. We've tried to alter China's behavior with carrots. Never worked. And we gave a lot away. And so I think that that policy issue is going to be there as well. And so you have the political uncertainty, you have some of these companies that are resisting, you have the USMCA, and then you have how we deal with China in the long run as some of the variables that we're going to look at for reshoring moving ahead.
Let's go into, it's so funny you mentioned, you know, the politics of it, right? We've gotten to, if this isn't rock bottom, I don't know what is, in terms of people's mindsets and just the dumbing down of America. But anyway, the car industry is going through a reckoning, right? Whether it's hybrid, full electric, gas. And again, now that's become political based on where you live, based on the infrastructure, based on what you believe, who you vote for, all those things. My question to you is tactical. What does electrical vehicle mandates and or, you know, emission by 2030, you have to do XYZ. What does that mean for manufacturing plants, for the industry as a whole? What does that do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a couple of ironclad laws of economics here, is that these companies are going to respond to public and consumer incentives and demand, okay? Mm-hmm. And they're going to calibrate their operations that way. And the problem for the United States had been that we were way behind in building up an EV industry in the United States. And part of that is because the car makers didn't want to do it for a long time.
Yep.
We've kind of passed that point now. And
wait, can I say why didn't the car makers want to do it? Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, look, they saw a good market for internal combustion engines, and they had an advantage there, particularly in the large vehicles and the SUVs and the pickup trucks. And you don't want to give that up. And it takes a lot of capital investment to pour into EVs, to make it a policy that's going to work. I mean, you probably remember that documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car? I mean, I thought that was, you know, and that was a long time ago. I mean, we've had this idea has been around there for a while. And I think what has changed though, fundamentally, is the global concern, and in the United States as well, just about climate change and how we address that. And so in viewing kind of EVs or at least non-total internal combustion engine cars as being part of the solution for that. Okay. So we've also at the same time seen battery performance improve and the EV experience where we've yet to see it kind of catch in is we got to get that price down a little bit. There has to be an EV charging network that is almost as convenient as gas stations, and we're still not there yet. And so we have the early adopters, but to get it to scale, that's what you need. But to your point, just about what does this mean for the auto industry? Right now, the auto industry has to invest in both. They still have to invest in internal combustion engines. They have to invest in EVs. The point is, people are going to start driving EVs. They're going to start driving more of them. Especially, they're going to like not having to pay for gas, you know, fundamentally, and seeing the performance of them as well as they get more convenient. And someone's going to make them. And so I'd rather it be the United States than have them come from Europe or Japan or Korea or China or Mexico. I mean, that's just me. I want the manufacturing jobs here. And so I do think we need those policies and that investment to make it work. But it also means that, let's face, you know, an EV takes less parts than an internal combustion engine car. That's going to fundamentally alter the workforce. And that makes it even more important that if we want thriving economies in states like Ohio and in Michigan and in Tennessee and in Alabama and in Georgia and in other places in Kentucky and other places where we're making vehicles, that we want to make sure that we're making the EVs here as well. And so that's why I kind of evangelize about this. And it's not that I'm favoring EVs over internal combustion engines, but unless we invest in the EVs, we're going to see a massive amount of deindustrialization again in a lot of these Midwestern and Southern cities. And I don't want to see that happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the frustrating part for me is, you know, there's the climate change argument, which, you know, I think at this point the vast majority of people understand is real and incredibly important. But the second thing that's a little frustrating for me is like it's not you're still going to be able to buy a gas car. It's okay. You know what I mean? It's no one's coming for your F-150. You can buy whatever you want. It's just, let's have the option, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's been fascinating to see because if, I mean, just to jump into the politics of it a little bit, the right pushes back on the EVs. I mean, the left is pushing for all of this to happen, right? This is Joe Biden agenda and he wants more of these.
Yeah.
But then Elon Musk comes around. And he certainly lands a little bit more on the right than he does the left. And people are really, I'll buy a Tesla. So it's like, it really does come down to, wait a minute. Do you don't want a Ford EV? Yeah. You just want a Tesla one? So I don't know. It's just frustrating. Like, it's just a lot of hypocrisy. But here we are.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we jump into the rapid fire, I want to talk a little bit about the documentary, Relighting the Flame. So I had a couple questions, but I just want to start with, you know, the motivation to create a documentary like this. Was it you and your team? Like, how did this all come about?
Yeah, that is a great question. And, you know, Relighting the Flame is a under 30-minute documentary that looks at the lives of workers who've been transformed by getting a job in steel mills in the United States, which is not the story that's normally told. It's normally about people losing their jobs. And I've seen some really good documentaries about that. So we worked with a Cleveland-based filmmaker, Carl Kress, to produce this film. And he shot in a couple of locations in Ohio and in Northwest Indiana. And was able to track a couple of, younger steelworkers, as through their careers and their home lives and how getting a job at the mill had kind of transformed them. And you see that they're homeowners, they shop, they have, they've achieved the American dream, which seemed out of reach, for them just a few years before that. And you've seen the rebirth of this industry. And look, it's not going to be a steel industry like we saw with tens of thousands of people working in a factory, 5, 6, 7, 8 decades ago. It's just different now. But the fact that it's been reborn and basically came back from the ashes is also a story worth telling. And that there's a new generation that is interested, engaged in this, and that these, going back to the original point that you made just about career and technical education, is that these are jobs that with some training, not a 4-year college degree, that you can be making $80,000 with benefits, you know, and that is like, you know, that is transformative for somebody. And so being able to have Carl shoot inside those steel mills and get those stories was something that we were keen, because it just, it runs against the grain of what I think the public perception is about manufacturing, about these careers, and about the arc of the industry as well, which had been down honestly for a long time, but is headed back up.
Yeah. And I think it's to your point around the positive, right? A lot of the times, to your point, it's about a closing of a plant or a building instead of the opposite. So I think that's so important to not only highlight what the job can do for an individual, but what's actually happening overall in the industry, especially as you mentioned, right? Like, 2 years versus 4 years, the traditional degree versus a vocation, you know, all those things. So that's amazing. How long did it take?
Yeah, I think from start to finish, the project took, 5 or 6 months to identify kind of the people, the locations to shoot, and to figure out the logistics, and all of that. And so this is the first time we've ever produced a film. so we learned a lot, but we were very fortunate to work with Carl, who's also done a PBS documentary about the Lordstown factory, and a lot of other work as well. And so it was pretty awesome. And then, I think you probably know this just from being in and around industry, is that, you know, doing factory shoots is also not easy, right? And so you've got to figure all that stuff around, especially in a steel mill where you're dealing with a lot of heavy equipment and a lot of heat. So it was totally worth it to do it, and we're really excited about what the response has been. I've in fact been blown away by the audience response to it, and it's just, it's streaming on YouTube, and it's, I think, our second most popular video we've ever done. And it keeps growing every week, and we premiered it in Cleveland. We had an awesome premiere, and we're going to premiere it in Indiana, in April, and then I think Carl's trying to show it at some film festivals around the country as well.
Nice, that's awesome. Congrats. That's as you can attest, I've never made, but I assume it is just an unbelievable lift to try and create any sort of film, documentary. I mean, it has to be rewarding to see it get such positive news.
Yeah, look, we had the easy part. We just did the green light aspect of this. Okay.
Yeah.
I think the hard part was both, you know, Carl and his team figuring out which workers work well on camera, because you need someone with personality who's willing to let you into their lives, which is, it's daunting to have a camera follow you around, right? And then with all of the footage that they were able to get, to piece that together and to slim it down basically, right, to about like 27 minutes, where they had, you know, dozens and dozens of hours of film, and just kind of condensing all of that into a product that works and tells a great story is not an easy task. So my hat is off to him. And I hope that more people have the opportunity to see it, because I think it will change your mind about what are the possibilities for a new generation of manufacturing workers using steel as kind of a backdrop for that. When the company believes in you, when, you know, you can have a good, well-paying job, also thanks to the United Steelworkers, and just what that possibility looks like. And it was awesome just to be a part of that.
I love it. Scott, this is great. We're going to get you out of here with our rapid fire questions. As soon as the answer comes into your head, fire it off. and then we'll get out of here. But first question, best piece of advice you've ever received?
Best piece of advice I've ever received is try not to say no for a long time in your life, and it'll serve you well. Be willing to take risks.
Love it. Especially 20s and 30s. Just say yes. Worst piece of advice you've ever received?
Clean your plate. So overrated.
All right. I like it. I like it. We haven't heard that one. What is the best and or favorite book you've ever read?
On the Road by Jack Kerouac. It hit me at the right time. You know, he's a beat writer, very controversial. The fact that he wrote it on a scroll in like one sitting, and it was this epic journey, showed America moving into kind of a new state. But I was really struck by it. Really cool book.
Nice. Next one. Who inspires you?
There's a lot of people who inspire me, and I've been fortunate to have a lot of mentors in my life. If there is some public figure, I would honestly say it's the Dalai Lama, and not because I'm Buddhist, I'm not, but just the amount of perseverance and endurance and all of that, and just the love of peace is something that I really admire. And I had a chance to meet him. Probably how long has it been? Maybe a little more than 20-25 years ago. So just really awesome.
I should have led with that question, how that experience was. My goodness, that's amazing. Good for you. The next one is favorite restaurants. Now, this one's going to be a little different because normally we're talking to people in Northwest Ohio, Cleveland, maybe Columbus, Cincinnati. So we're going to get some DC love. When everyone visits DC, where do they have to go?
I tell you, I'm just going to say I've been to Cleveland a fair number of times. I've eaten at some awesome restaurants. I ate a Brazilian restaurant in Cleveland Heights that was great. I've been a couple of neighborhoods. Just a lot. I've had a lot of great food in Cleveland. Okay. So, but the restaurant that is near and dear to me, and I've been lucky to eat a lot of different places, is the Tavern in State College, Pennsylvania, where I went to college. And it was just, my parents went on a date there many years ago, and it just has like, the food is fine, but it's just more about the setting that does it for me.
All right. The Tavern, the Nittany Lion Tavern. Okay. Last question. What is one question during this interview or past interviews that you wish you were asked?
What do you think about the Penn State wrestling team? Yeah. So no one ever likes to talk about college wrestling. And I'm a huge fan of it for a lot of reasons. But I just I could talk about it for a long time. So there's a reason no one ever asks, because no one else cares. But yeah.
Somewhat of a dynasty from my very far view that I sometimes see, that it just seems like they win every year.
It is an epic dynasty, what they've been able to create and sustain. And it's just like a lesson in how you build a culture. And I think there is an application to this, Paul. So it's not just a selfish rooting perspective, but how they've built this excellence that has attracted more of it. And it is like one of those places where they welcome the competition, and it lifts everybody else up in that room, and they make it fun too, which is hard to pull off. And I love that culture and how successful and competitive and fun it is. So I think there's a lesson there for a little bit of everyone. So, and they've had a lot of success too. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, if someone asked me the fourth question, who inspires you? I think in general, it's just sustained success, right? Mm-hmm. It's one thing to do something once or do it for a couple of years, but the people, whether this is sports or business, you know, if you're running a business you're Bill Belichick, you've won six Super Bowls in 25 years, how do you continue to answer the bell, answer the call, create the culture? That to me is fascinating, because you're right. It is impossible. And there is a reason that we have, the greatest of all time lists, and the list is very, very small. So I'm always fascinated by that.
That's exactly right. You nailed it. Yeah.
Okay, Scott, where can everybody connect with you? Where should they follow you, reach out, all that stuff?
Yeah. So first of all, our website is AmericanManufacturing.org. There's a lot of useful stuff on there. We have a daily digest of manufacturing related news that we sent out, and you can get all the videos that we discussed there. I'm on LinkedIn. You just, you know, type in Scott Paul, Alliance for American Manufacturing. Be happy to connect with anybody. And I also still am on X, and I'm at Scott Paul AAM on there, but would love to hear from folks and engage with them. Love the interaction with folks in this space quite a bit.
Love it. Scott, thank you so much. We really appreciate you being on, and good luck with everything this year, and we'll talk with you soon.
Hey, Paul, thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for elevating a lot of stories about about people and the industrial heartland. Very grateful for this.
Of course. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Rust Belt Rundown. Make sure you check us out at rustbeltrecruiting.com. The Rust Belt Rundown is available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Make sure to hit that subscribe button and click on 5 stars if you enjoyed this episode. See you next time.